Hello, I'm Rachel Allen.
And I'm Jack Underwood.
And welcome to the Faber Poetry Podcast.
To start us off today, we have a poem from Susanna Dickey from her debut collection, Isdal.
Hooey! Hello, I'm Susanna Dickey, and I'm sending in my poetry dispatch from the sunny, sunny fields of St. Albans. I'm sitting next to my open bedroom window, and I can hear the birds confabbing, which perhaps you also just heard. And I can also hear a dog sneezing. There was a football match earlier at the Mozzarella Fella Stadium, which is nearby, so perhaps the dog is allergic to the result. I am going to share a poem. For a bit of context, the Isdal woman is a woman whose body was found in 1970 by a young girl. So this poem tries to think about how a discovery like that could linger and recur and reiterate over the course of a life. This is, whenever you feel sad, you enjoy the smooth, refreshing taste of Diet Coke with lemon. The first person to climb a mountain did so intending to touch the moon. A resounding biblical failure, but anyway, this is what you will picture. Meeting her later in a place where later's no longer. You're finding her resigned to an impeached past, a time commensurate with a bus you once watched pass with little consequence, having no desire to be on it. All that is visible transitions into the retained or not retained, but sometimes a glitch in functionality means you still see so clearly the door of a house in a city you knew you would never return to. But anyway, when it came time to think about your obituary, you could never get past the impulse to talk about a door you saw once, lemon-coloured, and behind which lay things you could never hope to know. To follow a description of this door with, but I digress, and you say this now, you say to this woman whose obliterated body you found as a child, you say, but I digress. And in this timeless nowhere, she takes your hand and leads you to a shrub littered with anatomically impossible fruits. She says, there are the things you see that they don't see. And there are the things you see that they see. And there are the things you don't see that they see. But wait, you don't get to know about those things. You will look at the shrub and its impossible fruit. Behind the door was maybe another door. As behind one trauma, another trauma. Behind each unscheduled beginning, the need for that very beginning, and the fruit on this indelible shrub, always yellow. Always yellow, always firkin-shaped.
In the studio with us today, we have Lucy Mercer, whose debut collection, Emblem, is out with Prototype, and was the Poetry Book Society Summer Choice 2022. Lucy's also the winner of the White Review Poetry Prize. And yeah, it's so lovely to have you here, Lucy. Welcome.
And we also have Maggie Milner. Maggie Milner is a poet whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, Poetry, The Kenyon Review, Bomb and The Nation, among other publications. She's a lecturer at Yale and a senior editor at the Yale Review, and her incredible, erotic, moving debut, Couplets, is out now with Faber. We're going to hear first a few poems from Lucy Mercer, if you'd like to take it away.
Thanks. These are from Emblem, which was published in April, but last year. Westworld. When I hear stories of what happens to bodies, I cover the holes in my face, as my son, too, has a body. As if I could board up the unhinged doors and windows of this unfortunate saloon, leaving extreme worry out in the midday sun, crushing violets and sticking them onto cactuses, shooting deer that look like other cowboys, who, after all, learn from their mothers a reckless love of the pursuit of death. If I believed, I could ring up my heart's transparent attorney and ask, please, don't let him be horribly damaged. There aren't any phone lines out here. There don't seem to be any women either. In the sunlit display of the thoroughway, a greyser kneels in the dirt to crack a coconut. After watching its liquid flying about, he replaces it with the others on the stack. The top back on, not perfect, but back on. Like a television showing a fire in a fireplace. Perhaps our desire to order what breaks is our best human feeling. Like Piccinelli, who wanted to make a book of the world, he found a bundle that grew into a heap, then a huge shapeless mass, and felt compelled to dispose his chaos into some ordered design. It grows dark. Trees and streets are a grey gloop in the window. My son's favourite book is where you look for a man who hides in the middle of large crowds. We look at it again, our faces pressed close. At first it seems he's not in the picture, and so is unlikely to be found. But he is there, and in this book each question has an answer. Where is the man in a fountain? Where is the keen barber? The puncture caused by an arrow? A waiter who isn't concentrating? A dog on a roof? A boy attacked by a plant? Where is a man coming out of a manhole? Where are two firemen waving at each other? My son is sleeping like a peach stone. Tonight, after walking a world, the picture man opens his mouth for me, and I can see his throat looks the same as mine. He says, satisfactory questions. He says, where the answer has already been decided. Why are you looking out here? Criminal defendants. He says, history. Not this history. Your face, my face. No answers. A book but not a world. He says, a world but no book, like mine, cannot imitate your face. What you know now. What does knowing do? Has ever done? Who are you looking for?
Lovely. Thanks, Lucy. I love that image of the sleeping like a peach stone. Like thinking about how children sleep and what they look like. It must have been like poets have done that like for hundreds of years. And I think to come across such a sort of like accurate and striking image for that is really, well, I just like, I just go back to that line all the time and go, But rather than just some words of like mild admiration, we should talk about this book, Emblem. Could you tell us a bit about the sort of like general, there is a sort of conceit for the book, like although the poems don't always immediately like connect to that conceit, or it's not kind of like, well, you tell me, actually, tell me about
the book. Well, I suppose it's always like what you think your book is doing, especially what poets think their books are doing. And then other people are like, no, that's not what it's actually doing. This book was kind of inspired, as it were, by a book of 16th century emblems. And emblems were an early modern form where there was a picture, a kind of moralising motto, like the title of a poem and a poem underneath. So it was a kind of text image form. And I came across this book of emblems, but I couldn't read them because I can't read Latin and they're in Latin. But I felt that that was actually better because when I started to read the translations of them, I didn't really like them. Mm. So I kind of, at the time, I had a very young son, and in my head, these two things, motherhood and these emblems, kind of merged in an odd sort of way. So I was quite interested when I was writing this book as writing as a form of image. And actually, there's lots of it that I kind of struggle to read out loud, thinking about kind of introducing moments of kind of visual sense that are perhaps verbal nonsense within the poems.
So when you mean that when you're looking at something or you're kind of configuring an image out of the text, that kind of feels like an indoor process that's kind of more exacting. And somehow when you read it out loud, it seems like a sort of fumbling towards.
definitely. Or I think the way that when you this is kind of one of the things that interested me with emblems, that they say that your eye's always drawn back to the image, that it's a kind of centre. And I'm quite interested in the way that when we read, how we kind of assimilate a kind of multiplicity, as it were, which is more difficult to do when you're speaking.
And it is, I think, something that always strikes me about your texts and the book as a whole is just how much reference and intertextual play and other people's work and other people's words is woven into this really kind of lyric movement alongside the emblem text. And it feels very networked and meshed in that way. I feel like when I'm reading it, there's this kind of callback to publications that would have marginalia scribbled in or sort of footnotes, but it feels much more subtle in that way. Like it feels like those intertextual moments are more embedded, perhaps, which also feels closer to the idea of the emblem itself, which is an embedded kind of way of communicating meaning, I suppose. And I was reading the essay that you published on Granta, which is a kind of an accompanying sort of nonfiction text called Self-Replicating Textual Worms. And there's a really beautiful part in this where you talk about the word emblem coming from derived from the word inlay, as in a mosaic or an ornament, a detachable ornament, the insole of a shoe, or a cultivated branch grafted onto a wild tree. And it is so interesting how you manage to sort of combine all these various portals of meaning into this book. And that made me think of motherhood as well. I was like, okay, so the emblem is also the child and the way that you kind of intellectualize that idea of motherhood, but also don't shy away in your language and thematically from the loneliness, as you put it, of early motherhood. And I'm interested, I suppose, in how you personally aligned that very emotional and individual sense of early motherhood with this quite intellectual, I suppose, pursuit of reinterpreting or refashioning the emblem.
Thank you. That's really nice to, hear, like, all those things I hope are really relevant to the book. And it's one of those things, I suppose, when you look back at what you've done and you can kind of narrativize it or make more sense of it, like in the Grant article. But at the time, I didn't really see a similarity between the emblems and what I was doing, you know, in my day-to-day life, mothering. And I think that that is one of the nice things that, you know, like when poems surprise you or what you didn't expect sort of comes out of it.
There's that kind of like a very authentic sense of accumulation. Like we're talking about Where's Wally, you know, or like a torch that that's like a cat's mouth, you know. Like these are things, these are real things that you kind of, but then also like words or things that occur. And I love the way that those kind of things are kind of corralled into the thinking of the poems. Rather than the poems being like, this is who I am, like trying to root out some sort of authentic self-origin point. It's much kind of more kind of like messy than that. I feel that's like really what I find so exciting about this kind of like, this form of lyricism.
Thank you. I think, the authenticity thing, that's like good to hear. I think what, you know, if you're kind of referring to a very old text, in this case, a 400-year-old book, you kind of do quickly realise that it's built, the book it's referring to is essentially built from junk, like found stuff that may have never existed or existed in a different form. And there's really no, like, even for that book, a kind of authentic source. And I think to me, like, domestic objects, like torches or like, you know, plastic toys my son has or whatever, that to me that's equivalent value junk to well, be put together.
And tell us a bit more about like being about not reading Latin and writing about like a book in a language that you don't understand, because I think like that's I love that just as a kind of I don't think it's remotely kind of like a flex or anything. I think that's just like, oh, you encounter the object, it's interesting, And again, it's not, that doesn't seem like a kind of bullying or a grandiose thing. It feels just very like humble and interested.
And kind of fanatical as well, in a way. It's like, oh, I'm just enjoying the materiality of like a language that informs something that I'm doing, but that I can't, you know, interact with in a kind of representational way necessarily yet.
I think it also like totally talks to the history of the actual book itself, though, because most people wouldn't have been able to read. Most people didn't speak Latin. You know, it was a kind of, you know, that was a particular elite skill. And there's that wonderful thing in like St. Augustine where he's having a go at this bishop for reading in his head. And it's like, so there's a big debate. Well, not a huge debate. There's a debate. This is not like taking up.
It's going viral right now, this debate.
About whether or not that's because reading in your head was a much later invention and everyone just bellowed all the time. or if in fact, anyway, I'm digressing. But yeah, tell us a bit more about like writing about a book that you can't read and while writing your own book, which also you can't. You've just said you can't read.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I can't. I think part of it was, to me, it was also like having a baby and not being able to understand what a baby's saying to you. So I was in two situations where I couldn't interpret what was in front of me, really. But also, I think, and this is going back to images, if you can't read a language, I don't know, I think this with all like all, I, you know, every language I can't read, which is like all of them, you know, how it draws back to writing as a kind of form of picture, and the kind of sense of possibility that can give you. In a way, it's sometimes nice not to know what something's saying or, you know, what people are saying to each other, and you can kind of speculate. I've recently been drawn a bit to sort of medieval notation before notes became notes, and they had a kind of different form. And it's the same thing of something like if you see a music manuscript in this kind of early way, antiphonal manuscript, it looks like it's kind of got a message within it. But what that message could be, it sort of remains obscure. So I think it kind of goes into that sort of liminal space where you're not, you know, you're not entirely sure. And it can be quite sort of suggestive or useful in some ways for thinking about whatever you want to think about.
Yeah, it's nice because I often feel like there has to be some kind of fidelity or something to understanding wholly or like approaching something with a knowledge of it already established, and it's so much more interesting to have this, to see that site of unknowing as the site where you can generate work and meaning of your own.
But that's also acknowledging like the fundamentals of just language, isn't it? Like there's that sort of classic linguist's example, probably post-structural, I think, of like a rock in the desert and it's got these scratchings on it and you're like, did a worm make these? Was it the wind? You know, and like, and all you can really define with any certainty is that, or language begins when you can sort of speculate that something intended to mean something, like maybe a worm or the wind.
Right. Yeah.
Wanted us to mean something, but like the meaning is just like the discernible intention to mean.
And beyond that, we're all just like scrabbling around having a bash.
We're just worms on rocks.
Yeah.
Being troubled by the wind.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about image in the book, because the emblems appear and sort of drawings kind of crop up as well in book plates. And I'm interested in the kind of visual, the actually, I suppose, straight visual aspect that you wanted to include as almost section breaks. And there's a photograph as well. And I'm interested in how you sort of chose what to represent of the emblem book visually and how.
At the end, I kind of repeat some of the original images from the original emblem book. And I wanted to repeat them because I didn't want them to have a kind of fixed meaning. And I wanted to show that they could keep changing and be reused in a kind of sort of recycling or form of like composting, really. and then, yeah, like you say, there's a photograph that was of a flat that I lived in, and I was thinking about Ian Hamilton Finley's proposal for a sundial for Jean-Paul Marat, and it kind of has got this time, but I felt like at the time I wasn't living in a linear time, so I kind of drew a non-linear nonsense sundial on the glass with some chalk markers.
Yeah, because when you're up every 2 hours reading, it's like it may as well be 4 a.m, but it's 5.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I kind of wanted to keep the images in the book quite loose. Like what I didn't want above anything was for them to be illustrations, where it's kind of just describing what's happening in the image. I wanted them to kind of cause some kind of complication and tension. And like, in a way, they're kind of arbitrary, but I think that arbitrariness is quite important to the emblem form and maybe also to poems as well. Like, I don't know when, you know, if you read a poem and it's like, here's my title, this poem is about this, and then the poem's about that, then it also doesn't quite necessarily work as well. So
it's not the clear convention of saying, oh, this is for this, and you process this in this way. And I feel like actually generally your poetic voice is a bit like that. You ask the reader to do quite a bit of work, or just like imaginative, associative, intuitive, thinking through and feeling through. That seems quite central to your poeming.
Yeah, I hope so. I like his sort of associationism and like thinking about kind of thinking that isn't hopefully too literal, or that we want to, you know, make kind of connections between things. I mean, I suppose isn't that just like metaphor or simile, really? But
but they're essential to like poetic thinking and this kind of rooting out of poetic truths rather than the kind of habitual ones that we, particularly around things like subjects like motherhood or
yeah, I think because there can be a really interesting, I suppose, ambivalence in the poems where you're not settling on a certain way to show or perform or commit to an idea, and there's lots of questions and there's lots of broken sort of statements, I suppose, and broken assertions that almost make you feel as though you have there's a really, really interesting reading experience when I come to Emblem, because it almost feels as though you're scanning something that has been intentionally, there's like intentional erasure, but there's stuff sort of put into it. It feels like a very kind of I think, Jack, your word of like it's like an accumulation of different thoughts and feelings and associations that it's just a very graceful way of putting forward feelings about things and ideas about history and ideas about research and like lived research. That's what I think it feels like. The idea of motherhood feel like you've made motherhood feel like this space of accumulating knowledge, and you're presenting that process of accumulating.
Yeah, and arranging it in a way that allows the complexity of those various aspects of that experience. I don't know that I've spectated it. that like, I think, yeah, that rather than resisting kind of those reductive, you know, writing about motherhood, poems about motherhood, this book is about motherhood, you know, that kind of anecdotalism or literalism or realism, these kind of, I think I love the way that the poetic kind of leaves things, arranges things. Yeah,
I'm really glad about that. I think one of the things I do feel about, yeah, like you say, that there's a kind of tendency to write this anecdotal, understandably anecdotal writing about motherhood, and I'm sure my book hasn't escaped that either, but I feel like the maternal imaginary, as it were, and this is something that I felt very strongly behind writing this book, is so limited in this country in terms of like what mothers are expected to think and feel about and be interested in. And I think it's like actively harmful. So I don't know or think that my book has managed to kind of fill that space, but that's one of the motivations behind writing in that way, that it's kind of like we've got to expand that kind of space that's hopefully away from like Mum's Net forums and Instagram crafting or whatever it is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's nice, you do talk about the emblems having a kind of like a sort of quite basic communicative or like sort of moralizing that feels Instagrammy or something, but then you elaborate on their meaning outside of their moralizing or their like easy way of being interpreted, which links to motherhood again in that way, how we perceive motherhood and what we expect of mothering, parenting.
Mm. And mothering poems, which are often like, I went to the park. I mean, like, you know, can be a good poem, don't want to, you know, but there's just, it's like a very narrow band of what is talked about, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, it's sort of often very direct and just like literally about the wiping up.
Right.
And the pushing around and the, yeah. Maggie, we should talk to you. You're here. Hello.
Hello. I want to listen to Lucy speak forever.
Well, we're going to, it is, I'm afraid, we're going to force you to talk now.
It's time.
But then we will open up because we want to hear what you guys have brought in to show us today for the show and tell aspect. So, maybe you'd like to read to us from Couplets.
Sure.
I'm very excited to have the uncorrected proof here in front of me. So I'm keen to, I've been...
Yes, and I have the American uncorrected proof here, almost the evil twin or something. The parallel universe version.
It is.
Same color scheme.
Glossy. Yours is glossy though, isn't it? This one's...
Mine is glossy for some reason. Yeah. And the typeface is very 70s.
It's bigger and glossier, which is, I think, a workable transatlantic metaphor, maybe. I don't know.
Unfortunately. yours is, I think, a more aesthetic object. I will read from the first three sections of the book, the three poems that kind of launch the narrative. These poems are more or less in rhyming couplets, which you may or may not hear. And I'll just delineate the sections with the numbers. 1.1. All my life I've shown up late, but when I do, I compensate for my delay. I laugh and preen and carry on as if I had been present all along. I stayed in utero, for instance, 2 weeks after I was due, then came out so decisively and fast I couldn't breathe. I spent my first night on Earth alone inside a tent flushed full of oxygen, the event from which my dad believes have sprung like fires all my weird anxieties. Mostly I can't see myself at all until I sense in someone else a parallel. Like how I only realize what I want at the moment I attain it, my mind the final part of me to know. I've hurt people. I love being so late to my desires. Last year, I met someone I thought I couldn't live without, and in the process lost another without whom I thought I'd die. If I had only realized sooner, et cetera, et cetera. But I handled things ineptly, and he left. I didn't die. Instead, I went to therapy and saw the stegosaur uptown, stayed with friends, and drank a lot of tea. Even then, riding the bus to visit my new lover, I was breathless always, early, almost never. 1.2. She found me in the winter at a bar, one of those places in Bed-Stuy, not far from Clinton Hill. A platonic meeting set up by a friend who worked in media and thought we'd get along. I got there first and snatched a booth and started reading Middlemarch, a novel I've been halfway through for more than half my life. When she strode through the door, "Oh shit, I love that book. I've read it 15 times," she said, and asked my favorite scene. I looked down at page 98, open on the table. Maybe when Lydgate first meets Dorothea and Elliot's talking about how the stealthy convergence of human lots, when analyzed in retrospect, shows a slow preparation of effects from one life on another, I replied. Totally, she said. The conversation turned to poetry, our few mutual friends, one's PhD, one's startup, one's divorce. I was too skittish and caught up in my charade to feel charging the space between us like a ray, the knowing gaze of destiny, which Elliot would say stood by sarcastic with our dramatist personae folded in her hand. Besides, I practically had a husband, a man as opposite to her as Casaubon was opposite to Will. On the A train home, I read that paragraph again, then closed the book and marked the chapter, telling myself that I'd resume it after. 1.3. I thought she thought my life was trivial, since she was queer and edited periodicals, and I was a poet who had never dated a woman. Every night she'd attend some trendy function with people dressed in Eckhouse and Givenchy, while I shambled off to walk in shows at raunchy bars or raunchier bars that never put on shows. Or anyway, that was my perception. Now I know that hers were mostly networking events, book launches and openings, their settings, often even spots where I'd have grabbed a drink myself. Still, when I surveyed the fabric of my life back then, its familiar open work of sex and teaching, kale and NPR, and the boyfriend at the center I revered but felt I had been failing many years, I dreaded she'd dismiss me. Though when I looked at him and at my friends, I thought, how bad could my life really be with people like these in it? Gentle, loyal, practical, considerate. The difference was I knew my friends, I knew my life, while hers remained a vivid new reality that swirled behind a scintillating door, a world where people wore athleisure haute and seemed to vape incessantly, the sticks lighting up green or white like tiny pagers every time they'd pull. I hated the air that came out of them, the smell, like cleaning solvent or an afterthought of fruit, but found them mesmerizing too. I'd zone out and imagine that a tiny person lived inside each cartridge who would sprint to switch the light bulb on and fan the fire when she felt a drag. She must get so tired, I would think. This elaborate e-cig reverie was not so different from my theory of her life, which, because unknown, was also marvelous and false, complete invention. It took months to really reach her through the cloud of myth my adoration made. Until I could, I lived in fear she'd finally see my fetish and discrepancy and flee. I'll stop there.
Thank you. I'm a real, like, nerd for lineation, so... I think what I'm gonna jump in and ask you about couplets, which is fairly obvious place to start, I suppose, given the title of the book. And I was thinking about how when you're writing within within a form like or within couplets, that the way in which you've got a quite short space of time to turn around that little unit, that little measure, and the way that I think in the hands of like novices, people tend to like couplets or formal or rhyme becomes like this overburdening kind of constraint and not this source of like dynamism, not this little challenge which can throw you elsewhere. I wondered about that tension. I mean, it's a narrative mode, you know, like lots of couplet writers before you, like Pope or the big epics, you know. And I think that tension between narrative, where you know where you've got to go because you've got the story to tell, but you've got that little obstacle of you've got a house, so now you've got to find a mouse from somewhere, or a spouse, or a whatever,
or a louse,
yeah, or a louse, yeah, great. Or I guess you can have lose or loose. I mean, I like the kind of half rhymes. Do you think that kind of that the way that both inhibits and excites a narrative Was that your experience, or did you find it mainly like a pain in the ass to like puzzle through, or was it like was the puzzling the pleasure? Or
that's beautifully said. I think the puzzling was absolutely the pleasure, and I think I'm not necessarily a poet who historically has written in form, and I'm not a poet who has primarily been interested in narrative poetry, at least not in the kind of monomaniacal way that this book perhaps suggests. But I was writing, I think, from a place of real urgency in this particular project, where it really felt like there was a kind of anarchy to the experience that the book is describing, a kind of sloughing off of received ideas of role or form or the shape that a life can take. And I think in the absence of knowing what the hell to do with my life, these are concerns very much shared and reflected by the speaker, who is not exactly me, of course. I think there was this reaching or this grasping for a shape or a container or a kind of structure in the absence of previously kind of taken for granted structures by which to orient my life and my thinking. This is a book, to be explicit, that explores exiting a straight relationship and a monogamous relationship, and a very happy and stable life that is based in that relationship, for a really kind of amorphous and experimental life of queer romance and sex and non-monogamy and this experience of being quite unmoored from structures that were really, in some ways, very, very guiding and very helpful. And so I think the form, the reaching for formal constraint does reflect a desire for a kind of control that perhaps is elsewhere absent. And also to your question, was this source of kind of pleasure and play and delight in having to kind of find the louse that follows the house? There's a real sense of satisfaction, I think, in those moments of kind of knowing that you've completed the form in some sense. There's a fleeting sense of control or of gratification or of mastery. Of course, it's a very ephemeral sense of mastery that is predicated on ideas of kind of virtuosity and inherited forms that I mostly reject actually as a person, but there is something very satisfying about feeling that one has a formula to complete, and the completion of that formula is a delight in certain ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think like with rhyme in particular, I mean, I like the fact that you're sort of, you've both sort of discussed there the book is kind of reckoning with these moral questions about potentially hurting people that the speaker is in love with and cares about, and also the psychological effects and philosophical and psychosexual questions, which are sort of serious themes. But the rhyme is a kind of inherently slightly silly thing, right?
I was thinking of rhyme as this like it's a subversive act here, because it's like a
a tying up or a completing at every two lines of something that is like endlessly opening up as you move through the text. So you've got this kind of constant push and pull of kind of things looking like within the story they're spiraling out of control or becoming this kind of open and unknown plane, but that's contained within the most like sensical formal device that you can find. And it feels like something that is such a clever device for this, because it's when you talk about the kind of urgency of writing it, I feel like rhyme is sort of, it feels like maybe that use of rhyme was quite an urgent thing in and of itself. It's like you needed to bring this story back to some kind of formal refrain that would allow the story to be told in the open way that you otherwise tell it in the narrative.
Yeah, reading it is an interesting experience too, because the rhymes, and maybe this is relevant, the rhymes are very often, the majority of the rhymes are not perfect rhymes, and they're not end-stopped rhymes, right? They're enjambed and they're slightly slant, or they're some other kind of rhyme that's not perfect rhyme. They're assonant rhyme, or they're I rhyme in some cases. There's all different ways that once you get into this sort of arcane world of rhyme, you find that there's a million ways to kind of find a rhyme or define a rhyme. And that, when I began writing, this was, I loved what Lucy said about, you know, the ways that after the thing is composed, we kind of project all these narratives and meanings on why we made the choices we made, when of course the majority of, you know, or the experience of writing is largely unconscious of these resonances, but there's a lot of harmony perhaps, or there's an interesting rhyme, as it were, between these questions of homoerotic desire and of romance, partnerships and romance, and the couplet form as well too, in a kind of obvious, maybe even kind of kitschy way. But that was also sort of second. I mean, that was something that occurred to me maybe halfway through the writing of the book, which sounds absurd because of course that's very much on the surface. But once that occurred to me, it became really fun and ramifying to think about the imperfectness of each rhyme as having some as some kind of commentary perhaps on the perfectness or imperfectness or harmony or disharmony of the kinds of pairings that were occurring between the characters in the poem as well.
Yeah, I was actually amazed by the amount of perfect rhyme though as well. Like, I do feel like you really hit that.
I have to have it. I have to have a bit of perfect rhyme every now and then, just to kind of... But I also think that there's Auden, sort of, when I think about like somebody who's a big rhymer in some of his poems, and like, I think Auden's queerness and the camp of Auden and rhyme, like... I'm just sort of scanning through. I mean, even just like, which meant she could keep seeing me provided I agreed to polyamory. You know, there's sort of like, when you hear a rhyme like that, or there was one earlier, what was it?
My favourite is Barbara and Bank Robber. Because I feel like they're such a cool... I love thinking about rhyme and sound sense and like the chiming things that rhyme indicates, the associations that like rhyme creates.
But it does things.
I'm going to start rhyming.
It does
now.
Things to tone and syntax, like all those like love songs from the 50s, like Neil Sedaka singing "Oh Carol." Is that Neil Sedaka? Yeah, "I Am But a Fool, Darling, I Love You, Though You Treat Me Cruel." That sort of weird, wonky Shakespearean syntax that creeps in, which is not like, and Shakespeare didn't speak like that. He did it for the rhyme, you know. And I feel like the way that rhyme, or particularly the couplet, which is the noisiest rhyme, you know, the way that kind of it, like, changes the tone. Like in the 1.2, which you read, she found me in a winter in the winter at a bar, one of those places in Bed-Stuy, not far. I don't know, just something like almost like Raymond Chandler-y about the kind of shoe family. And I suppose that's part of like the campiness. Is that were you aware of the kind of like, so I used the word sort of silly earlier, but maybe a kind of campiness is more.
I love that. The, yeah. And also the campiness of the gay canon, the gay literary canon or queer literature is maybe the epicenter of camp in a certain way, right? That there's this very self-conscious performance of gender or of, high femme or kind of sexual stereotypes. Like there's a real, it's such a performative.
And drama,
subgenre. Like, and there drama, is this, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
The prose, I think it makes the sections that are in prose and the sections that have that kind of different address as well, because it does move from the speaker as I to a kind of addressed you. Mm. It makes those you sections really, really quite sort of like moving and dark when they do occur, because they do seem to occur in spaces where maybe that performance falls away and there's like a sort of glitch almost in the in the form that you've taken so much kind of solace in performing this story in. Those prose sections feel very like sinister or something, like emotionally sinister when they do appear.
I love that. Yeah, the dropping of the facade for a moment, maybe.
Yeah, like in those 50s songs when they're like, "Oh, Carol, I am but a fool." You know, when they do the talky verse and it's a little bit like...
Right.
That, which is also like, or Elvis when he says, "Someone said,
the
world's a stage," and you're like, "Yeah, that was Shakespeare, Elvis."
Anyway, there's a plainness, I suppose, to those sections that couldn't have been written from the I, and the protective device within those plain sections is the you. Yeah, it feels like for a text that's so open, it's so guarded formally. Like I think the boundaries that you're creating are form. And you're giving us this like incredibly open story within those formal constraints, those kind of guarded boundaries. Maggie, do you want to talk about the talisman that you bought in that represents in some way your poetic practice?
Well, I'm so glad you asked, because I've chosen this kind of disgusting and very large jar of peanut butter.
Oh, peanut butter. Yeah, it could have been anything, you know.
I love how stuff in America is just so much bigger. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I'm just like, God, I would love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do think it probably weighs more than my skull. yeah. So there's that. I go through one of these every couple of weeks, I would say. So
what do you do with it? to get through like one of those in a week?
Are you vegan? Because that's my
mind. I'm not vegan, but so I have a whole treatise, if you'd like to hear it, to deliver on why I chose this as my talismanic object. I eat it with a spoon a lot. So when I was composing this, when I was writing this book, I think I was eating more peanut butter than any other. That was my caloric intake was mostly in the form of peanut butter. It's a real comfort food for me.
Were you about to say, because I hope you were, that you were eating more peanut butter than any other human on Earth at that time? I feel like that's a claim.
I would wager that. I would challenge any listener of this podcast to come for me for that title, because I eat a sort of tremendous amount of peanut butter. And I was having this kind of fun biological / also metaphysical thought about the pathway by which this substance kind of becomes this substance, right? If the caloric energy with which I wrote this book was derived, almost entirely of this, what is the sort of molecular, what is the transubstantiation that's happening between this sort of disgusting jar of peanut butter and this and this very, you know, put together bound book object. But I was also thinking, in dependent maybe of my just love of peanut butter and my just the gustatory pleasures of this particular talisman, I was thinking also about form, as I want to do, and I was thinking about the kind of relationship between the gooey, sticky, delicious, unwieldy thing and the kind of structure of the container. Like a peanut, for example, is its own. Hear me out. A peanut
is its own container. Yeah.
But when it becomes this kind of, you know, when it becomes this totally disorderly substance, you know, we need a kind of structuring device, right? We need a form to contain it.
Do all peanuts have two kernels per, like, husk?
I think they ought to, but like, I think I have certainly experienced peanuts that are one-offs.
Tercets. Yeah, got it.
Tercets.
Yeah.
Monostitches, yeah.
So, but there are most peanuts, or at least some peanuts are couplets.
They're couplets.
Yeah.
Twins.
Nutlets.
That's a really, really good point. Maybe that's where it all comes from.
Implicitly, that's why you wrote the book.
Right, it was the peanut through me trying to return to some atavistic form of itself.
I'm buying it. Yeah.
Getting expressed through language. Yeah. So, I was thinking a little bit about just the way that the more unwieldy the material, perhaps the greater the need for a container. And that was maybe true of my experience of writing this book, especially as someone who, you know, hadn't worked in form in particular before, and didn't think that my first book would be formally motivated really at all.
That's a very satisfying talisman.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's neat, you know, not suspiciously neat. There was a little bit of like artifice, visible contrivance there.
Have you been asked this before?
But I liked it. Lucy, what have you got?
I brought in a mawkish paperweight of a cat looking into a mirror.
I'm going to hold
in
this
the style of a kind of. It's been in the sun, and it's faded, which I think adds to it.
It looks like the kind of thing you would find on your gran's, like, VHS player.
Yeah.
Very pseudo-Victorian. It's like a glass paperweight with this, picture of a cat looking. It's a cat looking at itself.
Could you describe the actual image a bit more?
That's also a couplet.
Yeah.
It's a cat looking at itself in the mirror.
Well, I noticed, actually, Lucy did show me a picture via text of this, and I did notice that there was some sort of, what was the line? Oh yeah, something, the mirror, its only witness. It's a last line of one of her.
It's melancholic. This it's animal melancholy.
It's very strange.
It's kind of looks a bit Beatrix Pottery, and I think it's printed out on A4. I found it at a charity shop. I've actually got two of these cat paperweights, and I can't really say why, except that I think there's something about it that makes me think of like Mary Riefel writing about sentimentality and poetry, and how you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't. And I thought I wasn't really writing a sentimental book when I wrote my book, but actually looking back, maybe bits of it were quite sentimental. And I love how she says that we have this kind of like active movement, like the red blood moving away from the arterial blood. We're like, yeah, we're going forward, like, you know, and then we've got the kind of the blue blood that returns. It's like sluggish and lonely and wanting. And I can kind of, yeah, something about the paperweight relates this to me, and also something about like wanting to kind of preserve things in this very odd medium, and something a very pointless artifact, you know, like when would you ever use a paperweight? Like, unless you like worked outside on a desk with paper. And
I'm trying to read this. trying to read the cat's expression.
It's like obscurely sentimental as well, yeah. Something like that. And it's almost like, I feel like when we write a book, or like the book object itself is sentimental enough that we probably spend so much time battling our way away from sentimentality, when actually, when you get the thing, you're like, oh shit, it's just one big... And then when you look at that paperweight, it's like they probably tried to not make it as like kitsch and sentimental as it is, which is like a cat looking at itself forlornly in the mirror in a paperweight.
The mirror itself is oval that the cat is looking into, and the paperweight is also oval. So there's a sort of dual mirror effect. You are also a cat looking into a mirror, maybe. I don't know, but the cat's also got both his paws on this like desk, this dresser before the mirror, quite sort of deliberately, as if he's gone up to look into the mirror at himself. So it's this sort of weird Lacanian...
Jack. Dilemma.
I don't know. I just feel like there's depth here, and the cat's expression is sort of not entirely forlorn. It's quizzical, but it's like he's been it's a genuine cessation. He's been interrupted and paused with his paws. You see,
I love that. I love that idiosyncrasy though that you map onto your own work. I find that it really is again a very suitable object, I think.
I'm glad.
Irreverent.
It is, yeah. But do you think, like, do you identify with the cat? Like, is there, that kind of looking into this kind of mirror quite, like, deliberately, but also, like, the reflection staring back at you is this sort of silly cat face?
Or maybe you could read us a poem that might make us reflect more on the cat's reflection, because we will have a poem by both of you.
Yeah, we've got to wrap it up now.
Yeah, I've got a very short poem about cats in the
perfect
book. There's quite a few cat poems in the book, and I brought this in, but I used to have cats. I don't have a cat, which makes it more tragic. Oh.
This is your cat now.
Yeah, this is the cat. Cat song. I would like a red, red, red cat, but I was given a green cat. I don't want it anymore. I would like a green, green, green cat, but I was given a red cat. I don't want it anymore.
I love it. So amazing.
Beautiful.
So, I want to frame that.
Yeah. God.
Make me that poem so I can frame it.
We should put it in a paperweight, I think.
That would be my dream.
Yeah. Or you could, like, instead of having, what is it? It's a sort of black felt. You could put that poem on the flip side of the paperweight. And anyway.
Maybe this is a new project for us all.
I think, yeah, exactly. Cat paper, a workshop. Any of you who listen to the podcast regularly, we will have links to the YouTube tutorial of making a cat paperweight with Lucy Mercer. We'll get that up real soon, I promise. Maggie, would you like to close us out by reading another poem?
Sure. I was very moved by that poem, Lucy, and I'll read the poem in my book that's about also not having a cat anymore and graduating from being a cat owner to sadly not being a cat owner. Although owner is such a weird word, maybe a cat companion. Although I'm afraid the just wildness and wonderfulness of Lucy's poem will overshadow, but that's okay. So this is addressed to the missing cat, and we'll close out with this. Oh, my little shade, not dead, not even lost, but lost to me as certain facts are lost. Two extra toes, eyes wide for your species, your shoulders bony knobs and scattered fleas. He kept you when we parted, never really discussed it. You'd always loved him better. And besides, any nothing I got, I deserved. But you'd loved me too, I thought, or trusted me at least to give you meat, the movement of my hands, my heat, and even tried to nurse in kittenhood some breast milk from my earlobe, drawing blood. Just be grateful you didn't have children, everyone said. I wasn't grateful, though in some moments was relieved to think that non-existence meant for them no suffering. Still, my private devil craved their suffering, which would have made my own more real, more sensible. And our love, and the way time pulled against the pent-up force of my life, which unhitched altogether from itself. Unhitched, like his belief, like you, who were to us less child than witness.
Oh, it's nice to end the podcast with cat loving.
Yeah.
Cat praise.
I think I'm gonna we're due another cat. I've promised my daughter another cat.
Oh yeah.
So I think
get yourself up that bloody Lewisham place.
This might be the Celia Hannam and Animal Trust.
That's where everyone
brilliant
gets
charity.
There.
Do do donate if you're listening.
Yeah, this podcast is not sponsored by Celia Hammond, but we would sponsor them.
We would, yeah. Thank you so much,
you
Lucy
guys.
And Maggie, for beaming in.
Special conversation, and have a lovely rest of your day. Bye bye.
Thank you so much. Bye. Such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Simulacrum. There wasn't love, but there was what love becomes. Sheet wrinkle, skin dune. Arm ropes lassoing our neck flesh with push and pull, equal amounts. The hurt convincing its shape is false. The relation, the recorded moment, he likes to record, to remember, not true. Then the film buffering, the unfinished triangle your body sculpts on top of his. Frustration, yes, rejection, oh yes. The colon's ring hammering, waking up, not again, not tonight, tight, loose, bloodless for now, dragging a palm across the brick wall, now, blood for now, streaming from you like scripture. Spit of him landing atop of your eyelid, a puddle of need. And there is freedom. There is intention to break your back in half and call it what you asked for, what our separateness will not allow. Rattle of wooden slats, indentations in the linen. This body you are finally inside of, being molded into the cushion's canvas by what desire has given him permittance to do tonight, tonight only. He is not a perfect fit, and that is perfect. He will not stay the night. He will not stay. Hard night, leaking night. No fine point, needled stars. The sky is a masculinity. He starts the car. Likes to be called daddy. Needs to be called something. Anything. There is your obligation. You're obliging. Call it gratitude. Be grateful. Give thanks. Give thanks.
So that was Simulacrum by Oluwaseun Oleyiwola, or maybe a part of Simulacrum, because I think it's from a longer poem. Mm. And I love this poem so much. I love its like stop, start, long line, but also kind of juddery parenthetical inclusions, the kind of end dashes, the short sentences, the long sentences. Like, it feels like the form, the formal stuff that Oluwaseun's doing really matches the, like, thematic concern of, like, bodies coming together in this way and the, I guess, like, awkwardness and sincerity of sex and... Mm. Just the, like, beautiful ephemera of it as well, like these rattle of wooden slats, the indentations.
Like, it gets beyond, quite quickly, beyond the kind of conventional sort of framing of sex and looks in the sort of marginalia, like both in the body and around the body. And, of course, like, central to this poem is also this kind of... I think willful, obliging, it says, like the power play of it, the submissiveness.
And like power is everywhere in this poem. It's like the sky is a masculinity. Like a puddle is made out of need. There are various kinds of intentions.
Yeah, like us, what our separateness will not allow. And like the molded into the cushion's canvas, it's kind of like, yeah, there's a sort of almost sort of like sculptural muscularity, a kind of viscerality. And like, I love the kind of that it's so like, it's very erotic and quite explicit, but kind of coy at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, even that's to do with like the withholding and the giving over, like even the voice and what it tells you has a kind of power play to, he's not a perfect fit and that is perfect. I mean, we like perfect fit as in kind of like perfect fit in my life, or are we talking about like sex here? Are we talking about like orifice and penis?
And it's mannered. I think the coyness comes from a kind of manneredness of the tone and the address. Like it feels very methodical or something. Like an idea of materiality, an idea of the body is being methodically kind of addressed or not dissected, but kind of like anatomized, maybe. But then the anatomizing feels very lyrically done. Like I think about when I read Oluwaseun's poems, I think about Jory Graham and I think about Sylvia Legree and I think about this kind of interrogation of what the language, how the language is dissecting a certain kind of scene and what that does to the scene and what that does to the language. And I think your point about like marginalia and ephemera here is really interesting because I think what he does is fold in the marginalia and the ephemera like into the body of the lyric poem. So what you end up with is this kind of scriptury, and I think he talks, well, the final line is like a prayer kind of, leaking out of the body like scripture, right? That's a line.
Yeah, and like the things that that seem peripheral but stacked up draw like what's within them. Like no fine point, needled stars, the sky is a masculinity. He starts the car. Like the jump from the sky is a masculinity to he starts the car. Even just like that, that suddenly means that the starting of the car has something to do with masculinity. And then he likes to be called daddy, but then he needs to be called something. There's a something way in like the way in which like the queerness and masculinity, their awkward kind of dance and the kind of need to like obliterate or be obliterated, the violence of masculinity within this sort of like obliging role play or power play. It's so like, it's all in there and it's like, it's like hot, this poem, but it's also like worrying.
I feel like it's like, it's negotiating in real time. It's like navigating and negotiating spaces, like bedroom spaces, bodily spaces, and that negotiation and that navigating is shown in these incredible little asides, parenthetical moments, the recorded moment, parenthetical aside, he likes to record, parenthetical aside, to remember, within another parenthesis, not true. Like there's this kind of layering of speech and this kind of layering of like narrative that feels like it's removing us and placing us at the same time. It's like oscillating. Yeah, it's navigating.
I can't tell whether the speaker wants it or is a like what where like obligation or ends and trust begin, or like the kind of like the brokering of this intimacy and what and the permissiveness. It's like it's difficult, I think. I find it a little bit difficult to kind of read just because I don't know.
That's what the poem's figuring out, though.
Yeah,
right?
I worry. Like, I worry for the speaker, you know. But at the same time, like if they want that, then and I don't know where the pleasure in that. It's just really clever.
Yeah,
I'm outmaneuvered.
Yeah.
By like.
And the time thing is really like talking about that. The time thing. It's like bloodless, for now.
For now, yeah.
It's, this is like, it feels both retrospective and looking forward and in the present in a way that speaks to, like, I suppose, like, endlessly repeated sorts of behaviours or expectations.
There, and there is freedom, there is intention to break your back in half and call it what you asked for. Like,
it's really powerful.
Very powerful. And I just sort of think the way in which the poem builds up this complexity and brings this complexity and difficulty within reach is, yeah, like, that's when lyric poetry, it doesn't always do that, you know. That's a real, like, feat to kind of to get into the kind of knotty, difficult, and even like ambiguous space,
yeah,
but in a way that sort of feels like controlled and uncertain. It's just really, really good. Like, yeah, there's something like holding this dissonant, conflicting, conflicted puzzle together. Real, like, high wire stuff. Like.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible.
And to end the episode today, we have an audio postcard from Rowan Ricardo Phillips, whose new collection, Silver, is coming out with Faber in April 2024.
I'm Rowan Ricardo Phillips, and this poem is called El Pintor. El Pintor. By the time you sketch it out, they're all gone. A different kind of murder you call art. It's Thursday, and all is ridiculous. The bourgeoisie, certain that anyone else is the bourgeoisie. August stranded in the bright ennui of inheritance, fall like soldiers onto this coastal town. As a culebron of clouds, suspended minor chords coax the sun from its sightless perch, and pale gold LeBron James jerseys dot the bars lining the esplanade. Un bar folie berger, this is not. And the perspective may or may not be messed up. But these people you see only in the wince of their summer orgasms, gouged out from their shells and soft as urchins, they want in. The back tattoo of the Dutch banker, the surgical scar of the Dutch banker's wife, the French couples who go Dutch on breakfast, tapas, dinner, and themselves, they also want in. Everyone wants in. To be described, or just some mortal sleep. That blank canvas behind our closed eyelids, where dreams save us, and we all become gods.
That was the Faber Poetry Podcast, presented by Rachel Allen and Jack Underwood, and produced by Hannah Marshall, Jack Underwood and Rachel Allen for Faber and Faber.
You can listen to our podcast on your favourite audio platform. And don't forget to subscribe, rate and tell your friends about our show.